The confirmation process for President Trump's Supreme Court pick, Judge Amy Coney Barrett, got underway yesterday. We're talking about this intense process where judicial nominees respond to both written and in-person questioning in hopes of being approved by the Senate. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer Kent. So with checks and balances, the president is given the opportunity to appoint a new Supreme Court justice who will then need to be confirmed by a vote in the Senate. 51 votes, a simple majority. Is a confirmation realistic by Election Day? Could the Senate vote after November 3rd? Bring your questions and what you're watching for out of these hearings. 800-642-1234. Lori Ringhand is a professor at the University of Georgia School of Law. She's co-author of Supreme Court Confirmation Hearings and Constitutional Change. And she proudly hails from Wisconsin, earned her law degree from the UW Law School. Lori, welcome home and welcome to the Ideas Network.
Thank you, Kate. It's a pleasure to be here.
Well, let's start with the opening statement. And Barrett stressed that courts have a limited role to play in our government.
But courts are not designed to solve every problem or right every wrong in our public life. The policy decisions and value judgments of government must be made by the political branches, elected by and accountable to the people.
What did you take away from her opening statement?
Yeah, so her opening statement emphasized the role of the court in simply applying rather than making law. And that's really fairly typical. Virtually all of the nominees of any ideological stripe tend to use that type of comment or rhetoric during their hearings. Now, unfortunately, it does gloss over a lot of the complexity about what the Supreme Court does, because justices, they do make choices when they're deciding hard cases about what the Constitution means. And those choices, they're channeled by law and they're channeled by legal reasoning. But in the hard cases, you know, the court has to decide difficult issues, and justices acting in good faith, they can and do come to different conclusions, which is exactly why this process is so contested.
And this is a process that you have been really digging into for years. You read the transcripts for every Supreme Court nomination going back 70 years. Why did you do that? What about that undertaking?
Well, I suppose it's a little perverse, but it was really fun, which is the main reason I did it. So transcribed open public hearings, hearings where the nominee comes before the Senate Judiciary Committee and takes unrestricted questions, questions about any topic that the senators want to talk about, and does so in public and under oath. That part of our process really started in 1939. With Felix Frankfurter. And what we see when we read these transcripts is that there's actually a surprising amount of continuity of how that part of the process has worked over time. The senators have repeatedly and consistently used the confirmation hearings to ask nominees about the issues that are important to the American people in that era. So they have always drawn on the confirmation process to talk about and illustrate how various constitutional rules, criteria, interpretations, how they affect the issues that people care about at the moment in time in which the nomination is happening.
Do the nominees indulge them when they ask them these questions about what's going on in that era? What do the nominees say?
Yeah, that's another thing that we found that has actually stayed much more stable than a lot of our rhetoric about confirmations implies. What we've seen is that nominees back to the beginning, back to 1939, really do the same thing. And what they do is they answer questions quite firmly about issues that the Supreme Court has decided that used to be controversial but aren't any longer. So they go ahead and they affirm kind of what the constitutional consensus of the moment is. At the same time, they have consistently since 1939 been much more hesitant to answer questions about currently controversial issues. And I think both of those things are really important. We tend to focus on the questions that the nominees don't answer about the currently contested issues and lose sight of how really important it is that we have this public process where nominees will sit under oath before elected officials and say, yeah, we used to fight about that thing, but we're done with that now. We've kind of reached a consensus on what the Constitution is going to mean to us on this previously contested point. And I'm saying under oath today that I'm on board with that. That's important, too.
Yeah, so you have to really look at both sides of it. We're talking with Lori Ringhand, who's a professor at the University of Georgia School of Law, Supreme Court scholar. We're talking about the confirmation hearings for Judge Amy Coney Barrett that got underway yesterday, and taking your insights, your questions about these hearings at 800-642-1234. Lori, Republicans appear to be in lockstep. They have the votes to confirm Judge Barrett on party lines. So why do the hearings matter?
I think the hearings matter because they are what keeps or embeds the Supreme Court inside our systems of checks and balances, right? We all know from our high school social studies or civics classes that our Constitution lays out a system of checks and balances. So each branch of government has some authority in its area, but it also has its power constrained in some way by the other branches of government. So by putting the confirmation of Supreme Court justices in the hands of elected officials, which is what the authors of our Constitution did, they made sure that the Supreme Court operates within that checks and balances system, not outside of it. Now, that doesn't mean that Supreme Court independence isn't important. It is very important. But what it does mean is that over time, there is this indirect accountability for some of the contested choices that the court makes when it's interpreting the hard parts of the Constitution. Because constitutional lawmaking, it's not math. Mm. Justices do have to make some choices. They have to make choices about how they're going to weigh competing expectations of the founders, competing interpretations of history, and maybe most significantly, they have to decide how they're going to apply the constitutional provisions where the founders very intentionally didn't write specific expectations into law, but rather gave us these big, bold words like freedom and liberty and equality. So justices have to figure out how to make those values work in today's world and what that is going to look like while also respecting their own institutional role. So all of that bundle of complexity is what is brought out and discussed at the confirmation hearings.
And so in this bundle of complexity, what do you think of Judge Barrett's qualifications and what she brings to this nomination?
Well, as a proud graduate of the University of Wisconsin Law School, I am delighted that she did not go to an Ivy League school. She is a graduate of Notre Dame, and I think that brings some really important diversity to the court. So I think that's absolutely wonderful. I also think she's plainly qualified. She has a strong record. She spent her adult life as a public intellectual. She's been on the Seventh Circuit Court of Appeals for a bit of a short time. I think she's been on there 3 years. But in terms of her objective qualifications, I think she's plainly qualified.
We're looking at the Supreme Court nomination process with University of Georgia law professor Lori Ringhand. Do you think that the Senate should be moving ahead with the Supreme Court confirmation hearing so close to the election? Do you want Judge Barrett to be confirmed to the High Court, or do you oppose her nomination? Tell us why. Either way, 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. Back in a minute with Lori Ringhand here on the Ideas Network. If you're just joining us, we're talking about the confirmation hearings of Judge Amy Coney Barrett here on The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Senate Republicans are unified enough that President Trump can expect to get his nominee on the Supreme Court in a matter of weeks. Do these hearings create a stage for members of the Judiciary Committee to make a final pitch to voters a mere 3 weeks before Election Day? Do you think that the Supreme Court has become too political, or has it always been this way? Join in 800-642-1234. We have University of Georgia law professor and Supreme Court scholar Lori Ringhand as our guide to the confirmation process. Lori, Judge Barrett is deeply religious, and several senators yesterday brought up her faith and the importance of securing religious freedom. How often are nominees' religious beliefs scrutinized or brought into the confirmation hearings?
I think they can be brought into the confirmation hearings in two different ways. One happened with nominees like Felix Frankfurter, who was the first nominee to sit before the Senate Judiciary Committee and take open questions. He was subject to really inappropriate anti-Jewish sentiment at his hearing. He was a immigrant. He came to the U.S. when he was 11 years old, and he did not speak English when he arrived. He had been an outspoken advocate of some liberal causes, including working initially with helping to found the ACLU. And at his hearing, some of the public speakers, as well as a few of the senators, came at him pretty directly about his religion and that it might inappropriately, or not even inappropriately, influence his decisions, but just that there shouldn't be another Jewish justice. So that type of bigotry and bias does have an unfortunate history in the Supreme Court confirmation process. The other way that people's deep-seated beliefs, whether religious or otherwise, of course, can come into play is when senators try to probe nominees on how they are going to make constitutional decisions, when they have this wiggle room, when there is a lack of clarity about the correct answer. What influences are they going to bring to the table? And those types of questions are not specifically about religion as much as they are about trying to understand what is going to guide the future justice's constitutional analysis.
Are there questions that you expect that Judge Barrett will decline to answer or will skirt?
Yes, it would be surprising if she didn't decline to answer some questions. There's been a lot of talk around her nomination, of course, about abortion and Roe v. Wade. And most nominees have declined to be very precise about what they think about Roe and whether they think it was properly decided or not. Now, interestingly, Ruth Bader Ginsburg, of course, the seat that Judge Barrett is being nominated for, she was actually fairly forthcoming about her belief that Roe protected an important aspect of women's equality. Of course, Ruth Bader Ginsburg, she had an extensive written record of advocacy on the issue, so it would have been awkward for her to be less forthcoming about that. It'll be interesting to see how Judge Barrett handles those questions. I expect that she, like most nominees, will evade answering them. But like Ruth Bader Ginsburg, she actually does have a fairly extensive written record on this point. And I'll be intrigued to see if she opts to defend her thinking on that or avoid answering questions about it.
We're talking with Lori Ringhand, if you're just joining us, co-author of Supreme Court Confirmation Hearings and Constitutional Change. We're discussing the confirmation hearings for Judge Amy Coney Barrett now underway. Do you think that the Supreme Court has become too political, or has it always been political? Does the country need to make reforms to the Supreme Court? Should justices have term limits? Questions to ponder, 800-642-1234. Let's bring in Jerry now, joining us from Woodruff. Hi, Jerry.
Good morning. Good morning. I hope I don't come off as a bigot, but on that issue of religion, it strikes me as very odd that currently six of the eight justices that are on the court now are Roman Catholic, and that the nominee now is also Roman Catholic. I have nothing against Roman Catholics, but about 22% of the American population is Roman Catholic. And it just seems to me that perhaps it would make sense to have at least a token, I don't know, a token Protestant, a token agnostic, a token nun, a token atheist.
So Jerry is bringing up this lack of religious diversity on the high court. Lori, what do you see there?
He raises an interesting point that we have often thought about the court in terms of how it represents the country. And it's the history of this is actually fairly interesting because some of the earliest nominations and the idea about representativeness on the court was geographical. The idea that when our country was defined, when people's identities were most closely or more closely defined with geography, it was important to presidents to nominate people who were geographically diverse. And then, of course, as our political community expanded, as different types of people claimed kind of their place at the political table, we saw that type of diversity expand to race and gender and religion, of course. So the idea that the court should represent in this kind of tangible way the public and the country that it helps govern is actually quite deep-seated.
Quite deep-seated, and perhaps does that go into the nominee, what the president is thinking when they put forth a nominee? Do we know what goes into that?
Yeah, this is one of the more opaque parts of the process because unlike the Senate confirmation hearings, the president's selection process is a little more veiled. And I think over time, presidents have obviously been concerned about representativeness in these various ways that we just talked about. They're also, of course, concerned with the constitutional consequences of the nomination, how the justice is likely to decide cases of importance to the president's political coalition. That's always been part of the calculation. And I think to some extent also nominee or presidents also care about chemistry. They are appointing people to these very important positions. And I think they do make choices in that regard as well. So the choice of nominees has for a very long time been about this whole cluster of issues, not just about kind of objective qualifications.
Looking at what happened yesterday in the hearing, there was a lot of finger pointing as both Republican and Democratic senators accused the other side of hypocrisy, of destroying the process and violating norms. Is there something to that?
You know, the appointment and confirmation of Supreme Court justices, I think the most accurate way to describe the politicalization of it is that it's cyclical. So we are clearly in a high point of partisan strife right now. And it's not surprising that that spills over into the Supreme Court. What you see studying the history of this is while that's not constant, it also isn't new. The Supreme Court has really always been in the thick of issues that people care about, whether it's, you know, way back in the day, the National Bank, the legal tender cases, the slavery and westward expansion, the New Deal, civil rights. The Supreme Court has always had its hands in this. And both presidents and U.S. senators have always understood that who sits on the court matters. And over time, we go through episodes where this is more or less contested. A lot of Americans today think that the politicalization of the process started in 1986 with Judge Robert Bork, but it really didn't. What we saw was that may have signified just an uptick in the partisan kind of strife of our era. But partisan strife has always been part of this process, as has manipulation of the number of seats on the court, how easily or difficult it is to confirm justices. That none of that is really new.
There have been 9 seats on the Supreme Court for a long time. Could that change?
Sure. I mean, it's not constitutionally dictated. It is simply a matter of federal statute. And as you point out, it has changed. And it's changed several times over our history. And interestingly, for the law students out there, one of the cases that every law student reads, probably the first case they read in constitutional law, is a case called Marbury v. Madison. And Marbury, of course, is famous for establishing the power of the Supreme Court to declare acts of Congress unconstitutional. But the underlying facts of the case was about a court packing plan. The Federalists were losing power, and they enacted something called the Midnight Judges Act and created a whole bunch of new seats and scrambled to fill them before the Jeffersonians came into power in Washington. So these types of conflicts aren't new. They're seeded throughout our history.
Supreme Court scholar Lori Ringhand from the University of Georgia School of Law, our guide to the confirmation process with all of this historical context. Do you think that if Judge Barrett is confirmed to the high court that Roe v. Wade will be overturned? What about the Affordable Care Act? Does the country need to make reforms to the Supreme Court? Questions to ponder. You weigh in, 800-642-1234. We'll pick this up with Lori Ringhand after a news update. Stay with us on the Ideas Network. We're talking about Judge Amy Coney Barrett's Supreme Court confirmation hearings that are underway in the Senate Judiciary Committee. It is the morning show. I'm Kate Archer Kent. So the rapid timeline Republicans plotted out leaves little room for error. And then there's COVID, right? The Senate Judiciary Committee is allowing members to appear either in person or virtually and has dramatically reduced the number of people allowed in the hearing room. What questions do you want senators to ask Judge Barrett this week? What would you like to know about her judicial philosophy and her opinions? Be part of this at 800-642-1234. We have University of Georgia Law Professor Lori Ringhand, who wrote a book on the Supreme Court confirmation hearings, and she's our guide. Lori, let's pick up where we left off on this idea of court packing. And no president has tried to change the size of the court since 1937, when Franklin D. Roosevelt introduced what came to be known as his court packing plan. Can you put this in historical context?
Yeah. So what had happened, the reason that FDR put forward that plan was because the Supreme Court had gotten kind of out of whack with the needs of the nation in the Great Depression. And the court was operating under a understanding of the Constitution that pretty dramatically constrained the power of the federal government to respond to the Depression and to the economic needs of the kind of emerging industrial economy. FDR kind of had the political mandate to contest that, to say to the court, you're going too far. You're exercising this constitutional discretion in difficult, contested areas of meaning in ways that are really hurting the nation. And his response to that, or one of his responses to that, was to put forth this court packing plan to try to grow the number of justices, to bring a different perspective to the court and ultimately change the court's decisions in that area. And it's interesting that he tried it, and it's interesting that it failed, because there was quite a bit of political backlash against the plan. And so from the public's perspective, there was a skepticism or a concern that that was the appropriate way to deal with the roadblocks that the court was putting up. But it also seemed to impact or affect the court, because the court is always very cognizant of its institutional role, what it should and should not be doing when the actual Constitution is murky in terms of how it should decide particular cases. And what we saw the Supreme Court do was kind of back off and let some of the New Deal legislation go forward and let the system respond and kind of self-correct. So I think that that's an interesting historic episode because among the it shows the political risks of being blatant in trying to manipulate the size of the court. Mm. But it also shows the risk to the court when the court gets too far, too disconnected from what the country needs.
Well, taking this to modern day, Chuck from Ripon called, couldn't stay with us. And Chuck says the Republican Party set a precedent ahead of the last election, not wanting President Obama to appoint a justice. Matt sent us an email saying the confirmation of Judge Barrett will enshrine minority rule for decades. Republicans stopped caring what the majority of Americans want. They should be ashamed of themselves. Matt says, I hope that Democrats start playing by the winner-take-all rules that give driven Republicans for decades. So with the issue of court packing today, what are you seeing? Because some on the left are urging Democrats to pack the courts if they regain power in the election next month.
Yeah, it's an interesting moment, and it's one of the ways in which what we're seeing today is different than what we saw with FDR's court packing plan, because what we've seen in the last several years is already a manipulation of the process. And the refusal to confirm or even give a hearing to Merrick Garland juxtaposed against confirming Judge Barrett this close to election, it is jarring. And I think that it has flagged the ways in which the court might be becoming disconnected from even a form of indirect political accountability. And that's going to have different consequences than what we saw in the 30s when FDR tried to increase the number of justices on the court. So in one way, this step is less surprising because there's already been kind of an uptick in gamesmanship around vacancies.
We're talking with Lori Ringhand, who's a law professor at the University of Georgia, co-author of Supreme Court Confirmation Hearings and Constitutional Change. We are looking at the confirmation hearing process, taking your insights and questions about it at 800-642-1234. Lori, you know, these hearings are happening at an extraordinary time with both a pandemic and the presidential election just 3 weeks away. How do you see that affecting this confirmation process?
Well, I think the fact that the presidential election is so close has certainly affected the way that the senators are approaching the hearings. I think there is a awareness and a sensitivity to the politics of the moment, and that's surely influencing the senators' questions. And you see this, I think yesterday you saw a lot of senators talk about the Affordable Care Act, Obamacare, and the possible consequences of this nomination for that legislation. And I think what was interesting about that was the issues like Roe and the so-called social issues tend to get a lot of attention at confirmation hearings, but the cases involving the power of the federal government are likely to be quite consequential as well. Because the power of the federal government in our federalist system, it's what was at issue with the New Deal legislation when we saw FDR's court packing plan. And restraining the scope of federal government power is something that many constitutional conservatives see as important. So that cluster of issues, the ability of the federal government to deal with certain types of problems, nationwide problems, is definitely on the table at these hearings. And I think some of the questioning that we're seeing or the opening statements that we're seeing and the questioning that we expect are going to reflect that fact as well as some of the more contested social and individual rights issues.
You know, President Trump has predicted that the November election will be decided by the Supreme Court. Do justices tend to feel beholden to the presidents who nominate them to the court?
I think the justices would certainly say no. Mm-hmm. Beholden is a very strong word, and I would be surprised, and I think it would be very unlikely that a justice would view herself as beholden in the sense that I owe this person a favor. Mm-hmm. I would not expect to see that at all. Now, of course, election law cases are themselves just seeped in partisan consequence. So justices are humans, and I think they have to work hard to make sure and to kind of test themselves when they're in those types of cases to be very self-critical about whether or not the partisan outcome is influencing their legal analysis. I think it's hard to do, but it's so important for the Supreme Court to do it, particularly in those types of cases, because they really do speak to the credibility of the system, the electoral system, but also the court.
Let's bring in Greg now in Sheboygan. Hi, Greg. What would you like to add?
Well, I'd like to just say, in the true colors of the Republican Senate has shown itself. I mean, we can't elect any of these guys back into office. I mean, seriously, they would not vote on Merrick Garland at all. And now they're trying to run this woman right through just because she's a conservative 3 weeks before an election, 2 weeks before an election. This has got to stop. We have to get these guys out of office. And I hope to God people look at Johnson and just say, what have you done?
And that's Senator Ron Johnson of Wisconsin. So, you know, Greg is bringing up the optics of this so close to the election. How does this impact the Supreme Court and how we view it?
Well, the Supreme Court's legitimacy is always in play. And the justices are perhaps more aware of that than anyone. And you mentioned possible reforms earlier. And the tension around this process, and particularly the circumstances of this nomination, one of the potential possible consequences of that is it might drive some incentive to do things like impose 18-year terms on justices. This is one of the ways that I think would be a great way to tamp down some of the tension around these processes while still maintaining the indirect accountability of the court. So if we had 18-year terms for Supreme Court justices, what we would see is every president would have two nominations with a senatorial election, a midterm election in between. That would really bring down the temperature, and I think that would benefit both Congress, the president, and perhaps most importantly, the court. So thinking, doing some hard thinking, we're paying a lot of attention right now to the idea of court expansion or court packing. It may be more worthwhile to think about ways to bring down the temperature while maintaining indirect accountability through things like limiting the term of service that justices serve. And I'm often asked, you know, what would I like the senators to ask nominees? I would like to see the senators start to ask nominees this question. If it became a norm on the court to voluntarily step down after 18 years of service, would you comply with that norm? Because one of the things that we can do here is to try to instill an expectation in the justices themselves. And because the justices are very concerned about Supreme Court legitimacy, I think there's actually space there to get the court on board with something like that.
Supreme Court scholar Lori Ringhand of the University of Georgia is our guide to the confirmation hearings, what to expect, the historical context, and the notion of term limits. Still time to talk, 800-642-1234. Back in a minute on the Ideas Network. It's the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Let's get back to our conversation with Lori Ringhand. She's a Supreme Court scholar, wrote a book on Supreme Court confirmation hearings. This time, COVID looms large. President Trump's Rose Garden announcement of Amy Coney Barrett as his choice to replace the late Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg was deemed a super spreader event by the nation's top infectious disease expert, Dr. Anthony Fauci. Democrats on the 22-member Judiciary Committee say they're concerned the hearings could be another super spreader of the virus. Let's hear from you, 800-642-1234, your thoughts on the hearings. Let's bring in Paul now, joining us from West Bend. Hi, Paul.
Hi, good morning. I'm very frightened with disappointment at her age. This woman, if you read her previous statements, both oral and printed, she will strip away the sovereignty of the woman or the women in this country. I mean, the sovereignty of her, of this woman, of a woman's body is going to be taken away, and you will be a criminal if for economic reasons or psychological reasons, medical reasons, or various other ones, that if she elects to have an abortion, that the state is going to say that she cannot do this. It's totally absurd. And this woman, believe me, she will vote to institute that law.
So, Lori, there's a lot of fear on the left that if Barrett is confirmed, it could lead to the overturning of Roe. Barrett signed a statement in 2006 calling it to be overturned. What do you think could happen with abortion rights with Barrett on the high court?
I think that Roe could be overturned. That would not be a surprising result, given the composition of the court. I think one of the hard things about the confirmation hearings themselves are how senators can get nominees to say meaningful things about issues like Roe, issues that are currently very controversial within the country. And some nominees just evade the issue. Others, like I mentioned earlier, Ruth Bader Ginsburg answered it quite directly. There's an interesting little sub-dynamic in the hearings of Judge Barrett. I think there is a sense on the political right that they've been burned on the abortion issue on some of their nominees. And she might actually see a little unexpected pressure from the right to be more forthcoming about her position on Roe. But I wouldn't expect her to answer it. But one of the things that senators may do is try to probe some of the underlying reasoning of the decision. And we see senators do that in a variety of areas to try to get the nominee to be more revealing about how they think about the question, even if they're unwilling to tell us what their ultimate answer would be on these contested issues. And that can be informative and interesting because, again, if one of the purposes of the hearings is to affirm an existing constitutional consensus, but also to try to illuminate the constitutional consequences of a given nomination, one of the ways that senators can help do that for the public is to kind of have the nominee talk through their reasoning, to show us why they think a particular result or a particular argument may or may not be persuasive. So I would expect that we will see that not just with Roe and the abortion question, but also again with some of these questions of federal power.
Let's bring in Mike now, joining us from Spooner this morning. Hi, Mike.
Hello.
Hi, what would you like to say? Go ahead.
I think Amy Barrett is a great nomination because she's going to follow the Constitution as written, not the law as they want it to be, which has been going on for quite some time. The Democrats don't like the Constitution, but without the Constitution, we have nothing. And that's all I have to say.
Mike, thank you. Lori, what are you seeing out of her opinions and her approach to the Constitution?
Yeah, well, I mean, all the nominees say that they're going to follow the Constitution. The problem is there's lots of areas where the Constitution is unclear. The Supreme Court only takes about 70 cases a year. And by definition, these are the hardest of the cases. They're cases where there isn't a crisp, clear answer. They're cases where the original expectations either differed among the founding generation or areas where those original specific expectations about how something like equal protection or liberty weren't actually written into the Constitution itself. So the Constitution doesn't, it's not a laundry list, right? We have kind of big words, and one of the things the court has to decide is how it's going to bring substance to words like freedom and liberty and equality. That's one of the hardest things that the court does because it's very, very attuned to its own institutional role when it needs to be rights protective versus when it needs to kind of step back and let political entities make make decisions in contested areas, every justice is aware of trying to balance that. And what we see over time is that the justices that we consider liberal versus those that we consider conservative, what they do is they use judicial power aggressively in different areas. So for example, right now, the justices that we think of as more conservative tend to use their judicial power to rein in the scope of the federal government. Justices that we tend to think of as more liberal tend to use their judicial power to protect certain types of individual freedoms and liberties. Conservative justices use their judicial power to protect different types of freedoms and liberties. So the problem is not that some justices impose personal preferences and others don't. Quite frankly, I think that rhetoric is not very helpful because these are hard problems. They wouldn't get to the Supreme Court if they were easy questions with easy answers. So the justices use the tool of legal reasoning. That's what makes what they do law, not politics, and channels the way they frame issues and make their decisions. But there's not, again, it's not math. There's not going to be a single right answer in a lot of hard cases. So justices have to make these choices. And part of the confirmation process, part of what it's doing when it's working well is illuminating for us how a given justice is likely to think about those issues.
Let me just reintroduce you here. Lori Ringhand is a law professor at the University of Georgia, and we're looking at confirmation hearings, the process, the historical context. Lori, if confirmed, I want to look at women on the court. If confirmed, Barrett would be the fifth woman ever appointed to the high court. How have women changed the Supreme Court?
Yeah, so I mean, I think one of the biggest ways is just by being there, right? And it's this idea of representativeness again. It actually matters in a democratic system of government that when we look at our governing bodies, we're able to see ourselves reflected back. So I think it's really important that the court be representative in that type of way. It adds to the legitimacy of the court when we can see ourselves actually exercising power. So that's important. I also think it's good to have ideological diversity. A conservative woman, a woman on the court, will help show the public the variety of opinion that women have and that they bring to constitutional questions. And I think that's good too. It's interesting. One of the things that we are studying, my co-authors and I, with the Supreme Court confirmations in particular, we're just starting to look at the ways in which the confirmation of female nominees may differ a little bit at the questioning at the Senate Judiciary Committee than that of male nominees. And thus far, perhaps not surprisingly, we have found that women get interrupted more. So that will surprise no woman who's ever spoken in public. And we will be curious to and keen to add Judge Barrett to our data set to see if that holds now that we have a more conservative woman at the nominees table.
Lori, thank you so much for joining us.
My pleasure. It was a delight to be here.
Lori Ringhand is a professor at the University of Georgia School of Law. She co-wrote the book Supreme Court Confirmation Hearings and Constitutional Change. 1A is next and continues to have analysis on these hearings. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. This is The Morning Show, and you're listening to the Ideas Network.